Blog Talk Radio.
The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Is January Jones. She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Wine, the 11th commandment that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware. Because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a terrific day. I'm January Jones, and I'd like to welcome you to our podcast today. You know, in life, we all wear many hats, and today I'm wearing my gold glitter hat because I'm creating a new brand, Glitter Granny Gifts, and it's an affiliate marketing at Amazon, and it'll be launching next month, so I'll tell you more about it. We'll be selling books and products with more info to come. Now, for my listeners, let me ask you a question. Okay, what do you know about counterintelligence? Yeah, probably not much, like most of us. Tell me, have you ever met an actual counterintelligence agent? Yeah, sounds pretty interesting. Would you like to meet someone now who can tell us about his experiences as an agent? Can you imagine what it would be like for the Taliban to request a meeting with you by name? No, I cannot. Also, would you like to hear some predictions based on his firsthand experiences regarding Ukraine and also the Russia conflict, which is on everyone's mind these days? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I'd like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Actually, it's Senior Success Stories. And I think my guest may qualify. Now it's time to rest and relax. Go get some wine, get some cheese and crackers, and join us in the No Wine Zone. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest today. He has spent several years as a counterintelligence spy for the United States Army, traveling to many countries, including Afghanistan, Egypt, Germany, Bosnia. He is a counterintelligence spy who will speak out openly. He has about 1,000 different stories and 1,000 different failures that he will share with today. These are never before heard and unfiltered accounts directly from the front line while under fire in some of the most dangerous regions of the earth. He started the nonprofit International Institute for Nonproliferation Studies, IINPS. It's my pleasure to welcome to our podcast today. Hello and welcome, Pete Turner.
Hey, thank you so much. I love it. Thanks for having me on the show. It's been great getting a chance to talk about all these things. And so I just appreciate you taking time.
Okay, I want you to share with our listeners where your actual success story began, where you were born, raised, and share with us who you were, your early influences.
Sure. But before we do that, do I qualify for senior success? I'm 54. Am I in the club or my little baby?
You're almost there.
Okay. All right. I'm getting there.
and since I'm 80, you're working with a real senior. So. Yeah.
And I'm
55.
So I guess to answer you.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, 55 is how you qualify. And pleased to share that I have four children who are officially seniors. It was crazy. The other day we went to a movie with one of them and I went to buy the tickets because that's what mommies do. And I ordered the tickets and I said, three seniors. And it just hit me. My kids are now seniors. So I hope is that I don't end up in some kind of a retirement home with our daughters. Because it was hard enough to raise teenagers, and then I don't think I want to live with seniors.
You know, it's funny. Every time I say my daughter is going to be 27 in May, I think, no, that's not right. Let me think about this. Is she 22? No, she, and I know how old my daughter is, but just my brain won't accept it. And then I always think, like, when I was 20, about to be 21, I was like, I can't wait so I can have this freedom of going to bars and all that kind of thing. And now I'm like, ooh, pretty soon I'll be able to buy a trailer in a trailer park for people who are 55 and older. I'm like, I'm almost there. I'm so excited to be able to start shopping around.
Yeah. You've got 1 year to go, but I think the AARP it welcomes people once they're 50. Yeah. So
yeah, you can actually sneak in before that too. They'll take your, if you want to subscribe, they'll give you a card and let you play along. So you're right about that. I am in the AARP world. Yes, indeed.
But, I am too. Okay, let's go back to where were you born and let's share your early success story.
Yeah, so I was born in California, in Oakland, and grew up in California. I'm multi-generational Californian as well, so just as Californian as you can be. And I, you know, my home wasn't a horrible place, but I didn't want to be around my dad. He was unpredictable, dangerous. And so I spent a lot of time outside of the house, which actually kind of served my professional purposes. I didn't realize this at the time, but that was one of the early successes was getting out of the house, doing things, becoming independent, self-sufficient, those kind of things. There's a lot of problems within that because I have a healthy, still to this day, I have a healthy appetite for rejecting authority, but I've kind of calmed myself over the years. But you need a lot of these things to be a spy. You need to be not afraid to leave your hometown and go to other places. And, you know, you can be anybody. You can be yourself in other towns when you're growing up. You know, you grew up with other kids, like you're the awkward kid from the third grade, fifth grade, whatever it is. It's hard to shake that, right? But you go to another town, you can also just be yourself. And I did that a lot too. So yeah. I would go find girls to date in other towns, and I played basketball, and I was just always on the go. And I think those early moments where I realized it was okay to be out and about in other areas. When you're a kid, if you're 10 miles from home, you know, that's a substantial difference. And so I met a lot of different folks that way, and it taught me how to be able to be a good guest. Yes.
And I would imagine in your spy business that you would have experience taking on different identities.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that is a potential skill set and a benefit. I think more importantly for me, I was able to be me and be honest about who I was in different settings. Because I personally, how I do my spying stuff is I'm always the same dude. I'm Pete, the guy from California. I might put on like, hey, I like to call myself Johnny Goodtime. Like if you see me, you're going to want to talk to me because who's that interesting guy, right? I have to do some of that because that's part of the thing. But the guy you're talking to is just an elevated version of me. So I'm excited because I want you guys to feel like I'm happy to be there. I'm happy to be your guest. I'm happy to talk to you about the things that you're fascinated by. Mm-hmm. That's really the only kind of, I wouldn't even call it an act. I would just say that, but I learned that by being a kid, going to people's houses, like, hey, stay with us for dinner and we'll take you home later on, you know, kind of thing. And so all of those things founded who I was as a collector.
Yeah, you know, it's your persona, and you're very outgoing, and I'm sure that that would help with your line of work. How old were you, Pete, when you actually joined the Army?
I was 24. I had already graduated college. I couldn't find a good job, and I had that dilemma of I don't have enough experience to get a job, but I can't get a job to have experience. And so I was pushing carts in the rain at Costco. And I was like, I have got to do something different. I can't seem to crack this code. I don't mind pushing carts. I love pushing carts, but that's not what I went to college for. And so I'm like, I have to make a change before I wake up 10 years from now thinking I have to make a change. And so I went from never considering the military to being in it in a month.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to hear about that after our break. And our break is for if you are a whiner, or if you know a whiner, this is for you.
Lately, there's a whining epidemic in our world. People are even whining about whining. Are you sick and tired of listening to everyone whining all the time? So was January Jones, the author of Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reached number one at Amazon.com. Ms. Jones based her book on a survey of the top 10 things that people whine about at all ages and all stages of life. January is a success coach that can tell you how to help others. When you buy Thou Shalt Not Whine, the 11th commandment, you'll find out what people whine about and how to stop them from whining. This is the perfect gift book to give or get for any occasion. Thou Shall Not Whine was voted the best gift to be given anonymously for those special people in your life. Ms. Jones is an internationally known author in the style of Irma Bombeck, specializing in housewife humor with her book being published in Korea and China. You can find Thou Shall Not Whine at Amazon.com.
Welcome back with my guest, who is not a whiner because he is a winner. Now tell us, you were 24 and with 1 month you decided to go to, what did you have, a revelation or some kind of experience?
It was just that, you know, I was pushing carts in the rain. I have a college degree and I was trying to get into TV as a sportscaster, and I worked really hard to do this. Back in the 90s, in the early 90s, and the way you did it was you set your tape off. And I was willing to start somewhere small and move up and be broke for a while. I was willing to do all that, but I couldn't even get that. I was at the, you know, the lowest market, Bozeman, Montana. And they're like, yeah, no thanks. And I'm like, to carry cables in Bozeman? I'm not good enough for that. All right, you know, it's a revelation when you're like, okay, I've got to do something. I've got to do something else. I was sort of just treading water, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is amazing that you said Bozeman, because I have friends, Paul and Nancy Kane, and they were both born there, and they are Montana just to the core, and I think they even have a summer home there now. Most people have not had the experience of going to Montana. I was fortunate to go there, and it's beautiful. But there's really, unless you're a hunter, there's really not much to do, is there?
Yeah, and I'm not knocking Bozeman. I have a lot of my aunt lives in Missoula, and so I had connections. I had connections to the TV industry, and again, no job was there to be found. And it wasn't that I sucked. It's just, you know, there were only so many jobs to go around. Mm-hmm. And so I was ready to go to Bozeman, though, and like, that's not where I'm from. That's, you know, way off, like, it's not even close to Missoula. But I was willing to go there to start my career, but there was no career to be had.
Oh, okay. And so you enlisted. You weren't drafted. They didn't draft in the 90s.
Right.
Enlisted in the Army, and where did you train?
There's a place called Fort Huachuca, and it's sort of the spy school for the Army, and the United States military sends a lot of people there in general. So I went there for my counterintelligence training. And that was about, I don't know, like it's a little more than 4 months. And in that 4 months, you're busy learning all of the very, very basic things of how to be a counterintelligence agent. So that's where I started all of the official counterintelligence stuff.
Mm-hmm. 4 months. Wow. What an experience. Okay. And I can't believe they could teach you all of that in 4 months. It must have been really intense, wasn't it?
It was, you know, I was so new and so foreign to the military, everything for me, like how to, all the acronyms and all of the other words that I went into the education center one time, and it was called the RASCON Center. And I asked the lady, what does RASCON stand for? I pointed on the wall at a dude, his last name is RASCON. And I'm like, oh, like that's how like everything was a new, it was a whole new world. So I had to learn a lot. And so it was more about inculcating and learning how to be in the military. You got to keep in mind too, I am a type A personality when it comes to professions. And so I am going to find the things that you have to do well, and I'm going to push hard on those things, which in the military, if you stand out, if you are faster, if you're stronger, if you shoot straighter, if you know more than the regulation, that kind of thing, it makes you a bit of a target for the people, and they get a little jealous of your hard work and results. So that was the biggest lesson I had to learn, was how to be in the Army and not be so damned aggressive when I'm just a person who likes to compete and I'm cocky about it. And that, you know, this is the younger version of me. But yeah, so the biggest thing for me was not so much the training, because the training is pretty mundane. It's a lot of boilerplate and writing and learning regulations and stuff. But the other stuff later on, when I was self-studying my way into these things and not getting to the relationships that I needed to create within the Army so that I didn't harm, my aggressiveness and eagerness was seen as a trait instead of how it was seen was as like, hey, Pete's a jerk, you know, because he's running around and kicking everybody's ass and bragging about it.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you had to kind of tone it down and rein it in a little bit. Out of curiosity, were you married then or were you single?
Single. Yeah.
I would think that would be a real big pre-request of any of the counterintelligence agents. I think not having a family to deal with would be a big plus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard on a family. You know, when people thank me for my service, I think about my daughter, you know, and I love my daughter and know my daughter well, but I don't have the relationship with her that anybody who grew up and raised their kid face-to-face every day. I don't have that with my daughter. And so in a lot of ways, I'm still getting to know how to be your dad, you know, because I was gone for a long time. So when people thank me, I think about her and the sacrifice we have made in our relationship. And we get along great, but, you know, it's just we don't have that thing that I would imagine a regular parent and daughter would have if I had been able to be around more.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you miss a lot. And our generation, our husbands went to Vietnam. And at that time, they were gone for an entire year for one tour. And if they did more tours, they were really gone a lot. Very hard on a family. Let's now, okay, you graduate, you're a counterintelligence spy. Were you allowed to tell your family what you were doing?
Yeah. Because we, you know, I say spy because that's ultimately what I was, right? But at the time, you have all of like the lingo that you say. So I'm a counterintelligence agent. I collect information, you know. But the reality is I'm going out and trying to find out things I'm not supposed to find out. And if the enemy was to catch me, you know what they would call me? They'd call me a spy. So I could tell people what I was doing for the most part. Most everybody, this is the funny part, January, is most people don't believe me. So I'll say, oh, yeah, I was a spy in the Army. You're like, yeah, whatever, you can't say that. I just did it. They never believed me.
Yeah, you were more, I would say, overt versus covert. And so that would be a big difference in the work you would be doing. So, okay, so you are then, your family knows about it in probably a general sort of way, not too many details. Where were you sent? What was your first assignment? What was that like?
I went to Germany. And so in Germany, it was sort of like the leftovers of the Cold War era, you know, like World War II put us there. Cold War kind of divided out where we did things. And counterintelligence people have a mission when they're in garrison, when they're home in Germany. And so I fell in on that mission and started just learning what I needed to learn. They put me in operations, and so I was at the headquarters of our little counterintelligence company, and so I just was available to do whatever was needed, which a lot of times, honestly, was chores, you know, trim the hedges, go clean up this, take all this junk to the dump, a lot of that kind of stuff, But my peers were out in field offices. They were wearing suits. They were using their badges. They were doing investigations. They were doing clearance investigations. So they were doing a lot of things there. And again, here's me chomping at the bit. I'm not here to be cutting hedges. I'm here to dominate. How do I dominate? And so you got to imagine you got this thoroughbred bounding around in the paddock, like, what can I do? And they didn't know what to make of me, you know?
Okay, so you were in Germany cutting hedges. And then when did it start getting exciting?
Well, you know, when we do our training, it is exciting and it is fun. And so when we would go to the field, they called this a strategical unit. So we were part strategic, part tactical. So we would tactically deploy to the practice area, our lanes where we would work. Mm-hmm. But we would do strategic work. So we'd be in our green uniforms running around, kind of faking it, because the truth is counterintelligence agents aren't all that, like, hardcore. You know, we don't like to be dirty and that kind of thing.
Right.
You'd wipe off the paint if you'd put any on your face or whatever, and you'd put on some civilian clothes, and then you would drive into a town. The town was Aschaffenburg, and so we would go and do operations where we would do, like, meets and surveillance training and counter-surveillance training and stuff like that. So during the day, because I was in operations, I ended up being a role player. So my time in operations sucked for me, what I wanted to do the job. But when I went into the field, I had all of these pros who had done this job for a long time, and they would come to meet me, Pete, the mayor from Aschaffenburg. And so I'd be in a little cafe drinking my hot chocolate all day. Hello, yes, I'm Pete, the mayor of Aschaffenburg. And I would watch and I would learn from them how they were running sources. And I kind of gathered all of their tricks and their trades. And we would do a debrief afterwards. And I would ask them questions. They would ask me. And I learned so much by having all of these repetitions that my peers didn't get, because they got maybe one or two meets. I got 100 of them.
Okay. So you weren't just dipping your toe. You were jumping right into the action.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take another break, but when we come back, I want you to tell the story about how the Taliban requested a meeting and asked for you by name.
Yes. All right, let's do it.
Let me ask you a question. Are you still wondering who killed Kennedy? Over 50 years later, the assassination is still a mystery. It is unfinished business for our country. Now, get ready for a theory that you've never heard before, but will make more sense than any other conspiracy theory that you've ever heard in the past. January Jones speaks the unspeakable in her book, Jackie, Ari, and Jack, The Tragic Love Triangle, connecting Jackie and Aristotle Onassis romantically prior to JFK's assassination. Did you know that Ari was Jackie's guest in the White House during the JFK funeral? He was the only non-family member who was invited by Jackie to stay there during the funeral. Aristotle Onassis was one of the wealthiest men in the world, with the means, the motive, and the money to order an assassination that was the perfect crime of the last century. Ari needed class, and Jackie needed cash. They were perfect for each other. Now, what is Camelot? It is but another tragic love triangle. Jackie, Ari, and Jack is available at JanuaryJones.com, Amazon.com, and Audiobooks.com, read by Ms. Jones.
Welcome back with Pete Turner. By the way, Pete, you were in California, so you didn't go back to settle in Bozeman or Missoula, did you?
No. Yeah, I went back to California, and then I joined the Army from Oakland. I left and started serving. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then after Germany, I would assume your next assignment might have been Afghanistan?
Well, we went to Bosnia during my Germany time as part of the Dayton Peace Accords that were designed to hold that Bosnian-Serbian peace. So that was during my time in Germany. So I was there for 2 years, and half of that time-ish I spent over in the area for Bosnia. And that was neat because I got to actually do my job and leave the camp every day to go determine you know, how the peace was holding. And it's a very unique time in military history where the spies were the tip of the spear. It was our job to go out and find out what, you know, because that's not infantry people, that's not tanks. They had no fight at all. It was us that we had to go out and determine these things. And it was really for the time for me to really get just, you talk about diving in deep, that's diving in deep right there, because we didn't know how dangerous it was going to be. So I got a chance to do spy work every single day.
Oh, how exciting. First, before we talk about Saddam and the Taliban, when it came to interpreters, did you get to, how did they match you up? Could you choose who you wanted, or were you assigned, or how did they even interview for jobs?
You know, I don't know how that process works. I do know that I had these interpreters, and they would provide us with them. And for the most part, I tried to use the person I was given, because there's a finite amount of them. And I looked at it as my job to teach my interpreter how we were going to work together. And I got better and better and better and better at this as I got more experienced. And we just actually had a show yesterday, and we were talking quite a bit about interpreters, because how we treat them usually is pretty negative. And so I'm like, I'm not going to do that. This person and I have to go do very dangerous work. I need them to trust me that I'm looking out for them. And I need them to speak in a way that allows them to get the information that we need. And so my question may not be the right question. They know culturally what direction to go and how to navigate that conversation. And so I focused early on developing my relationship with my interpreters and being fierce on their side, because frankly, Americans, first off, we call them Turks. They don't like that. Call them John, call them Dave, call them interpreters, but don't just minimize them to just the word Terp and then look down on them. And so I spent a lot of time with those guys trying to understand what it was like to be them. And so I could improve their condition with me and make it so that even though we worked hard constantly and it was dangerous, that they knew that I had respect for them and wouldn't let anybody else mess with them.
And did some of those relationships continue after you left the Army?
Yeah. There are a number of interpreters that I still talk to this day. Absolutely.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Now, so where were you? What country were you in when the Taliban requested to speak to you by name, which would terrify me? So I want to hear about it.
Yeah. First off, I didn't know that this was going to happen, and I was in Afghanistan, and I was in a little village way off the main route. So we were way out in the middle of nowhere. I was on a little army outpost, but and our outpost had a security bubble of, let's say, 300 yards. Anything inside of that, no one was going to get too crazy because they would lose that fight. But as soon as you got more than about a quarter mile away, things got different, right? And there was a lot less security and safety. We still went out every day, but we had to provision through airdrops, you know, so airplanes would fly over, you know, once a week and drop stuff down into us. That's how remote we were. Mm-hmm. So we're working with this local governor in this far-flung district. And, you know, we'd made a lot of strides during the winter. Like while the Taliban bed down, we were working hard and developing influence. And so one of the days, my buddy Rich and I, we were working, and the governor said, "Hey, I want you guys to go down with me tomorrow night and go to," we'll just say the name Dave. "We're going to go to Dave's house, Dave the farmer." Dave's obviously an Afghan, but in this case, let's keep it Dave. So we're going to go to Dave's house and meet a bunch of farmers and do the standard conversation thing that we always do. Like, "Oh, that's great. We'd love to do it." We had no idea that this was in any way a setup at all. So the next day we walk off the camp, walk past the government center. We're walking closer and closer to the edge of our control, right? That doesn't mean that Army wasn't watching and looking out for us, but we didn't know there'd be any more on alert. So they just knew that we were going a couple, and really it's a couple houses away. They're farmhouses, so there's some distance. But we sit down, have this meeting, talking to all these farmers, and we just do what we normally do. And again, we're overt, and so I'm not hiding what I'm doing. I'm being honest about it. I'm here to help. I want to understand you guys. I want to get the Americans so that they understand, you know, all these things that I do. And the meeting was over, and Rich and I walked home. No big. And then the next day, the governor, you know, we go down to see him, and he's like, "Hey, I've got to tell you guys something. That meeting yesterday at Dave's house, well, the Taliban set that up, and they wanted to assess you guys and decide what they were going to do." And I'm like, "Jeez." He's like, "Yeah, I had no say in this other than just to set it up because that's what was required. And he's like, they like you and Rich. They see that you respect Afghan ways, that you're not trying to change us, and that you, you know, were men of letters, educated. And so they highly respected that. And they gave us license to operate in that area. And, you know, and ultimately that's good. That's a mark that the way I approach this works, because I'm not trying to, I am trying to help people. I'm trying to reduce threat in the area. I am trying to help us build up their government to their benefit. And so, yes, I'm concerned about bombs. Yes, I'm concerned about bad guys. Yes, I want to meet them and make them my friends, but I don't start with that. That's not like, I don't walk around town going, where are the bombs? Where are the bad guys? Where are the bombs? Where are the bad guys? Because you'll never meet those guys that way.
Wow. That's, I mean, if someone, if they had requested me by name, I would have freaked out because I would have wanted to know, how did they find my name? How did they know me? But since you were older.
Oh, I want them to know my name.
Yeah. You were very.
I want them to know my name.
Yeah, you were very accessible to them. That's a great story, though. And then also, I want you to share with us a little bit about you used a source who was a former assassin working for Saddam Hussein. Now, you must have had a hell of a good translator for that.
I did have a very good translator for that. I do want to say this. I want the enemy to know my name. I'm the same guy. So the same guy that talks to the colonel is the same guy that talks to the Taliban. And so I love it when the army comes running up from the intelligence shop and like, Pete, they know your name. They're saying, we've got to find Pete and kill him. And I'm like, yes, this is good, because it means that I'm on the field. Because my job's not allowed to be safe. Safety is not the thing I get. I have to push myself out and interact with the enemy in a way that causes them to react to my presence. And if I don't have that, but I'm not done my job. So I want them to know my name. I want them to see me working. And I want them to be like, oh, yeah, that dude. Yeah, we know him. Yeah, he's really influential. He has a network of friends. So that's the close of the loop on that. So with that in mind, I'm in Iraq working with the team I'm on. And I don't feel like I know anybody. And I'm just there to help and just trying to figure out how to renew to Iraq and everything. And we go over to the SEAL camp, and we're talking to the SEALs. And one of their chiefs looks at me. He's like, I know you. And I'm like, you don't know me, man. Nobody knows me. He's like, no, I know you. And so we figured out that he had gone to a course that I was an instructor at. It was a spy course, and he had gone. And he's like, you were awesome. You were great. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to leave, and I'm going to give you Johnny Walker. He's an interpreter, and he is fantastic. We're going to want him back, but we don't want Special Forces to get him. So you guys use him. He'll be fantastic for you. And so Johnny and my team and I, we all worked and we used Johnny, and Johnny introduced us to this assassin. And that guy was just as, look, he's a regular person, but his job was horrible. And so if you remember in The Departed, Jack Nicholson is shooting people on the beach right at the very beginning of the movie. And he laughs how the one lady, when he killed her, how she felt funny. Well, this dude in Iraq, he said that to me before The Departed. And he said, yeah. So I remember one time I was shooting these women and their kids, and they would fall, and it was just hilarious how they fell. And I'm like, this is a cold, cold person to laugh about the people killed. But you got to meet nasty, evil people to prevent nasty, evil things from happening. And you got to turn them into your friends. And so that's, again, like, I'm not afforded safety in my job. I have to go meet these people. I have to tolerate them, because if I don't, well, then they're left to their own devices. At least then I'm negotiating with this person. I'm trying to calm them down. I'm trying to access their network so that hopefully I can do my job.
Just out of curiosity, you said Johnny Walker. Do they give the all these names? Are they all names of liquors?
No, it just, he liked to drink, and that was his persona. And so they gave him a name. You know, all the interpreters have some kind of name to protect them. So I've worked with a guy named Cheetah, a guy named Jaguar, a guy named Ford, a guy named Night Train. Night Train could be booze, but he wasn't called that because of that. He was more about his lifestyle.
Yeah, that's the military way of doing it. It's your call name. We're now retired many, many years, and we're in a group called the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, and we meet all through the year and month and do things together. And they all have call names, you know, and that's what they go by. They don't use their real name.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of used to it. We're going to take a break and tell you about some priceless personalities who have been here with me on the show.
Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable? Someone who has touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems? People who have struggled to find solutions? People who fearlessly shared their stories? People who have not only informed you, but inspired you? People who have priceless personalities? I have been fortunate to host an internet radio talk show called January Jones Sharing Success Stories. And it has been my privilege to interview hundreds of guests. My guests have shared their stories, their struggles, their secrets, and their successes in their own words. In this book, we're talking about people dealing with problems such as incest, molestation, runaway kids, child abuse, drug abuse, polygamy, unemployment, scandal, and starting over. Then there are my guests dealing with difficult physical struggles such as blindness, cancer, and birth defects that are beyond traumatic. My guests have all been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. They have amazed, amused, and even astonished me. I have adored getting to meet them, and I adore sharing them with you.
Attention all listeners, Priceless Personalities, Success Stories Shared by January Jones, Volume 2 is now available at Amazon.com in paperback and Kindle editions. You'll be able to meet 10 amazing people who will be sharing their own personal stories with all their struggles, successes, and solutions sprinkled with lots of humor and hope. Priceless Personalities features a teenager who becomes one of the famous Supremes from Motown, a nurse who as a humorist helps people to heal, an inspiring laughter yoga instructor, a mother dealing with the loss of a child, an incredible motivational speaker, a woman who married 5 times, a gifted paranormal nurse, a wise economist, a funny female humorist, along with an older man sharing his sweet childhood in the Deep South. January's guests are all amazing and amusing. You will never forget meeting them. Go to Amazon.com for your own priceless experience.
Welcome back with a priceless personality visiting us today, Pete Turner. Aww. Pete, before we close out, I love having you here and I enjoy talking to you so much. But let's talk about the International Institute for Nonproliferation Studies. That's a long title. which I could say a lot faster. It's a think tank, right? And why is it different?
So, here's the thing. The first thing I did was I changed the damn name of that place. So it's the Ground Truth Center. It got a lot more simple. Yeah, so we still want to worry about nonproliferation of nuclear weapons, which apparently is still a thing. And we still for sure want to focus on reducing the amount of corruption that we cause and how it impacts us. But really what we're talking about is linking the ground truth people like me, people who have to go out and be the point of contact for U.S. foreign policy or any kind of national policy, whether it's education or health or whatever it is. People like me who go out and they're like, what you guys think is going to happen and what I'm able to accomplish here, these are not the same thing. Uh-huh. And so I'm trying to close that gap between the academic theory, between the legislator, the diplomat, all of the people who are making these choices, answering these questions. How do we improve something? And the actual mechanic at the bottom who's like going to be like, hey, your idea is adorable, but around here, that's never going to work. Here is what I can do, right? And so hopefully that communicative path, if I can link it, we can make better decisions and have better expectations and more properly train that mechanic to go out and do things because it's more closely tied to reality. That's what the goal of the Ground Truth Center is. And with that comes smaller, less ideologically based, like what's practically, what can we do practical today to make the strategic goal, get fed a little win, as opposed to let's go spend $120 million on building this building and then have nothing come of it. You know, that's so wasteful. Let's reduce that.
Okay. And is this like, do you meet in a place or is it all done on the internet, or how do you, how many people participate, and how do you come up with policies?
Yeah, so I don't want to come up with policies. I want to help people that are trying to come up with policies. So, like, if we're going to deal with homelessness, I want the governor to call me and say, Pete, we want to deal with homelessness. We know that case management is a vital piece of this. We want to make sure that we have a relevant solution or a policy that's going to include, you know, it's like when you have stakeholders, right? You're like, okay, we're having a stakeholder meeting. And I'm like, where are the customers? You know, or where are the Iraqis? Like, we're making these decisions. Where are the people who have to bear the brunt of that decision? And that is what we're trying to do. So it's think tanky in nature, but more I'm trying to be consultative approach to trying to improve our decision making, so that when we provision things, that it's a little more accurate. I'm not saying anything bad about anybody in this whole process. Everybody's trying their best. Everybody's trying to solve big, complicated problems. But what I've seen from my own firsthand experience is that we aren't any good at it because we have no idea. I call it the spaceship, right? If no one ever leaves the spaceship and they're trying to decide how someone should farm on the ground, that's impossible. You can't do that. So you need people that can talk to the farmers to help the spaceship say, oh, this is how we help the farmer. I would help the farmers all the time. I would do this all of the time, Jerry, where I go out and I would say, what's the smallest thing we could do today? Like, we want you to hire foreign labor to bring your crop in. And then the Iraqi farmer would laugh in my face. I write down in my book, laughed in my face. And then he would say, there's no amount of crop that my family can't bring in. It's impossible. I will always have another cousin. I will never hire an outsider. And I'm like, okay, now whether that changes, that's not up to me. But what I can tell the spaceship is, hey, they will never hire migrant workers to bring in a crop. That's not a thing around here. You know, so that's sort of the idea, is to shrink that gap between the policy and the practitioners.
Yeah, and to find out what's really going on the ground, that the other people are probably, as you said, they're in spaceships, they're too remote. Before we close out, share your thoughts on what's going on in the world now with the two wars that our country's dealing with. What thoughts do you have on those?
You know, it's anyone standing firmly on the mission probably doesn't know enough. We all have our things that we want to have happen. Uh-huh. And we have our bets, but ultimately we just don't know. I mean, Russia is not going to stop. And Ukraine's not going to want them to not, they're not going to stop. And so we have to figure out, how do we get this war to stop? This war is horrible. And what we often lose track of is that there are people that are dying every day. There are primarily men dying in both countries. And that means women are going to be subjugated and put in a horrible situation. So it's not just the death, it's the next 20 years of what happens to these people as they try to dig out of a hole. And that makes, to me, like, the bigger thing is just the inhumanity in our policies and our approach to things. It's terrible that this war has gone on this long. And there's people using the theories and the policies to try to exact a win, but it's at the cost of a lot of human lives. So I would say ultimately the Russia conflict ends at some point, hopefully this year, I'm hoping, and that America and Russia will sit down and they'll negotiate some kind of deal, and some piece of Ukraine will probably break off and go to Russia, as I think the most likely scenario today. And I hope it's not a bigger piece, because Russia's still trying to push in. And, you know, we're Americans. We've seen hundreds of millions of dollars, trillions of dollars in the last 25 years go out to no effect. And so I think people are sick of that. So I don't know that a whole lot of Congress people are like, hey, I really want to send $500 billion to Ukraine, you know, followed by reconstruction. Oh my God. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. But it's contentious as hell. And
it is.
The Israel-Hamas fight, I think the best person to look at for guidance on this is a guy named John Spencer. He's a friend of mine, and he focuses on urban warfare. And a lot of the narratives that come out of that fight are inaccurate, and they don't paint an even picture. If you find yourself hard on one side or the other of this fight, you're probably not dealing in reality, I would say. It's tough to say that, but the reality is this is war. War involves a lot of people dying, and neither side wants to quit. So, like I always say, the fastest way to get to peace in this fight is for Hamas to say, we surrender, here are all of the kidnapped people that we have. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do that. They haven't had the will knocked out of them yet, right? And Israel certainly isn't going to stop. And so when we talk about all these other things, like that is the crux of this. Hamas started this particular war. They did it as gruesomely and as horribly as possible. And right. So the only way for it to stop is for Israel to either beat all of the fight out of Hamas or Hamas to say, okay, we're done getting all of these negative things. But you don't see either side wanting to do that because they still got a lot of fight in them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's like the proverbial impossible thing to solve. There's no right and wrong. And I think most people can see that there's two sides. Maybe not so much with Russia, but in the Middle East, there's definitely two sides, and they both are fighting so hard. It's just a very sad, sad situation. On the lighter side, I'm going to ask you a question.
Oh, good.
I ask all my guests before we sign off, and if you could invite someone to dinner besides me, living or dead, who would you like to have dinner with?
You know what? I never got to face-to-face meet my grandfather. I've learned a lot about him. I've actually got a pile of his letters right here from World War II. I'm slowly putting his story together. So it would be great to have that conversation with him. I think we would have because of my unique experience in war, no one in my family has as much war experience as I do. So when I get a chance to talk to him, they always have all these questions. And he is the one person that has a significant amount. And so it'd be great to talk to him.
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. Great answer. Because everyone's picking famous people.
Yeah.
But that's a very personal, special answer. And thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you so much for coming on the show, the podcast with me today. I've enjoyed having you. And I think we've learned a little bit from you. And I hope you'll come back again.
Anytime.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, dear listeners, hope you've enjoyed our time together today. We tried to be very informative and inspiring today. My upcoming guests will all be eclectic, exciting, and energizing, just the way Pete was today. So much fun. Now, my 80-year-old thought for the day, enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. It may be later than you think, or it may be now or never, my dear friends. So for now, thank you for entering the No Wine Zone and share our stories and our show with everyone you know. Remember, you need to stop whining right now and then start smiling the way Pete does. And if that doesn't work, then you can just go out chocolate, lots and lots. Pleasure signing off from the Glitter Granny. Take care and stay safe until we meet again. Bye-bye.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Story. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.
Don't be calling me saying when they're coming. Your phone is on the kitchen table. Your phone is on the kitchen table.
So everything I left on the bed is clean, except for that big black comforter, which I don't know what you guys want to do. Okay, ready to go? I'll look right back. Which car? Actually, it's a verbal, right?
Yeah.
Okay, bye, bud, home. You'll see a full girl. I love barking. Good girl. Thank you.